Okay, 2 Samuel. We are going to be stepping into the middle of a story by starting this book. Have any of you watched a movie that was a sequel and you missed the first? That's what this is going to be like if you have not read 1 Samuel, because this is going to be stepping in to, like, if you've watched Lord of the Rings and you come in with the Twin Towers and you never saw the first, read the first book or something. This is a sequel to 1 Samuel. We taught through 1 Samuel a few years back, and if you want, you can listen to the messages online. But this is a story of transition in Israel's history from the period of the judges to the period of the kings. And it's the story of moving this nation from a theocracy where they're governed by God to a theocratic monarchy where God is still their ruler, but he's ruling through kings. And the first book of Samuel really was a book that described a king after the people's heart. They wanted a king, they requested a king, and God gave them a king, but it was not a king that was really after God's heart. Saul started out well, but he didn't end so well. And so that's what 1 Samuel covers. And then 2 Samuel is going to be looking at the king after God's own heart. It's going to be looking at David, the shepherd king. And David has had many years of preparation. A huge part of 1 Samuel is focusing on his life and him in the fields, him at the palace serving King Saul, and then him in the wilderness running from Saul. And you might think, or you might hope, that finally David, once he gets to become king, he gets to enjoy the happy golden years, and that suffering is behind him, and he can kind of relax. And yet, we're going to see in this book, these are not the happy golden years. They are years where he continues to have turmoil and trials and tribulations. Some of them he brings upon himself. Not all, but some. Success can be another form of peril. And there is going to be a significant event in this book where David sort of eases up on his responsibilities and he kicks back when he's supposed to continue to be pressing forward, and he gets into trouble as a result of that. So this book is about triumphs and tragedies, and there's no historical photoshopping. There's no historical editorial cropping. The person who writes this writes about the good and the bad and the ugly, and it's all in there for us. And I think there's a benefit to this, because David, for many people, is well-loved. And I think for that reason, or the reason for that, is that he's relatable. He's like the Peter of the Old Testament, where he's all heart, and sometimes he makes some big mistakes in life, and yet he recovers from those mistakes. He knows what to do after those mistakes, after those sins, after those blunders. He runs back to the Lord. So it is a story about tragedy. It's a story about triumph, but ultimately it's a story about God's faithfulness to this man and this man's unbroken faithfulness to God. How many of you have read the book Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand? Okay, a couple people, a few people. Good. It's on my reading list. I have not read it. I'd like to read it at some point. I have watched a movie by the same title, Unbroken. And it's the story of Louis Zamperini, who was a prisoner of war during World War II, and the tribulations and trials that he experienced being downed plane and having to survive in the Pacific for, what was it, 47 days or something? A long period of time. And then being a prisoner of war camp that the Japanese oversaw. And the title is Unbroken, but something the movie misses that is in the book and in his testimony is he came home a very broken man. He was defiant and he was determined during his years and his time in the prisoner of war camp, but he came home very broken. And it was only through him hearing a Billy Graham message and responding to an invitation to give his life to the Lord that he became unbroken, that he, as a broken person, became whole again. And Samuel, the book of 2 Samuel is like that. David is a man who's unbroken in his faith, but he is a broken man who God puts back together again. So we're going to look at that. One person has described this out of every adversity. And it's taken from something David says at two times in his life. 2 Samuel chapter 4, verse 9. David says this, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all adversity." And then he says the same thing. It's 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 29, that God had redeemed his life from all adversity. And this isn't just the adversities that Saul had caused, or the Philistines, or other people around. These are the adversities that he himself caused, and yet God redeemed his life from all of these things. So redemption's a key part of this book. Some have summarized that the first half could be described with triumph, chapters 1 through 10, and then the second half is dealing more with trouble, chapters 11 through 24. And so let's go ahead. We're just going to look at chapter 1 tonight. We're going to look at lies and lament. So look at the lies first, verses 1 through 16, and then the lament, verses 17 through 27. Let's read verses 1 through 16. "Now it came to pass, after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, that David had stayed 2 days in Ziklag. On the third day, behold, it happened that a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. So it was, when he came to David, that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. And David said to him, 'Where have you come from?' So he said, 'I have escaped from the camp of Israel.' Then David said to him, 'How did the matter go? Please tell me.' And he said, 'The people have fled from the battle. Many of the people are fallen and dead. And Saul and Jonathan, his son, are also dead.' So David said to the young man who told him, 'How do you know that Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead?' And as the young man told him and said, 'As I happened by chance to be on Mount Gilboa, there was Saul leaning on his spear.'" I don't think he happened by chance. We're going to talk about this. I think he's there looting the dead bodies. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But he says, "I happened by chance to be on Mount Gilboa. There was Saul leaning on his spear, and indeed the chariots and the horsemen followed hard after him. Now when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me, and I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' So I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.' He said to me again, 'Please stand over me and kill me, for anguish has come upon me, but my life still remains in me.' So I stood over him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the bracelet that was on his arm, and have brought them here to my lord." Then David took hold of his own clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening, for Saul and for Jonathan his son, for the people of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword." We're going to save verses 13 through 16 here for a moment later. So it begins in verse 1 where it says, "It came to pass after the death of Saul." 1 Samuel ends with the death of Saul. And it also says, "When David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites," and David had stayed 2 days in Ziklag. If you remember, David had left Israel, and he's down in the southern western region near the Philistines, basically in the Philistines area, and he's at the city of Ziklag. And he had befriended one of the kings, one of the rulers there in the Philistine area. And for a couple years, he's an outlaw. He can't live in Israel because it's too dangerous, but he's run away to the enemy. And the enemy thinks that David's burned his bridges in Israel. So he's been there. And then there's a battle that's going to happen between the Philistines and the Israelites. And the Philistines go, and this ruler invites David to go along. And David's stuck between a rock and a hard place because he doesn't want to say no, but he really can't go fight against his own people. So he goes, and then the Philistines, fortunately, see him, the other rulers, and say, this guy can't go with us. He's killed many Philistines in the past. We don't trust him in battle, and so he needs to go back home. He heads home. He finds Ziklag burned. All of the wives, all of the children are gone because the Amalekites had come and done what the Amalekites often do. They pick on the people who are vulnerable and weak and in a place where nobody's able to defend them. And so all the women and children are gone. David weeps till he can weep no more. The people are ready to stone him because they're grieved and they don't know what to do. And David strengthens himself. They go and they chase after the Amalekites and they rescue all the people, all the wives, all the children, get all their stuff. And now they're back in Ziklag. And they're still waiting to hear the outcome of the battle between the Philistines and the Israelites. During this time, Saul is in a place where he knows God has left me. He's not hearing from the Lord. And so he goes to a witch and he tries to get information. And through a series of unique circumstances, he gets to talk with Samuel, who's passed away. And Samuel says, you're going to die in this battle. And Saul's grieved. He's overcome and he doesn't know what to do. But he goes back home. And so there is this battle, and he does die in the battle, and Jonathan dies in the battle. And the way that the narrator in 1 Samuel records his death is that he's injured severely, and so he asks for his armor bearer to thrust him through because he knows he's not going to be able to escape. His armor bearer does not do it. So Saul takes his sword, and he falls on his own sword, and he dies. This is what the narrator says, that Saul kills himself, commits suicide there on the battlefield. The armor bearer does the same thing. And so they're in the they're on the ground. And now we have a different version. We have another story here where this guy comes along and he says, I found him injured, but he's not dead. So we got to kind of piece these things together. This is a bad time for somebody to come to David and say, I'm an Amalekite. Because the Amalekites, just a couple days earlier, had stolen and kidnapped his wife, his children, and everything else. But this guy does not know that. But this guy also knows where David is. And I wonder, how did he know where David was? The other Amalekites knew where David was camped. And so there's some pieces of information that are not told here, but it seems it's just interesting. So he shares his story. And I think this is, it's all drama. He's very zealous. He comes about 80 miles. Mount Gilboa is about 80 miles away from Ziklag. And he's aware where David's camp is. And I think this is, a drama. He puts on a costume. I don't think he's really grieving, but he makes the attempt to show that he is. He acts out. He falls before David on his face and doesn't speak. Like he can't speak until David says something. And then I think he begins to act. And then he has a script. And so he goes through. And again, there's different stories. So some people think that Saul didn't actually die. And he fell on the sword and he's still alive on the ground. And he turns around and he sees this Amalekite and he's groaning. He says, can you put me to death? Because I'm going to die. And can you please just kill me right now? So some people think that. I think this guy's probably, we don't know. Maybe that's the case. But if you look at the Amalekites and you look at their reputation in all of Scripture, do you have any reason to ever trust them? No. Do you ever see any time where they show sorrow, with this exception, if this is an exception, over other people who are suffering? No, they are always, always, always taking advantage of other people who are suffering. And so I don't think this is an exception here. I think this is another story of an Amalekite taking advantage of somebody who's suffering and who's dead, somebody who's in a vulnerable terrible place. And so I think what he's trying to do is save face. He's looted and found the king, and he thinks, this is a golden opportunity for me. I might be able to get a position with David if I get to be the first person to share this news? And so he takes some pieces of identity to verify that he had found the king dead, but he doesn't want to say, I found the king dead. He wants to try to not have to say I was looting on the battlefield, and I just happened to be walking by, and I did a heroic deed. If he was really doing a heroic deed, he would probably try to hide the body from the Philistines, because you know the Philistines are going to take the body away and use it as a trophy in their hometowns. He doesn't do that. He just takes something that's going to benefit himself. So I think all of this is a cover-up over his own glee over the tragedy of Saul and him trying to get some advantage through this. David probably sees through this. I'm sure that he sees that there's certain holes in the story. And yet, he puts this on hold and he spends time grieving. He weeps. And he tears his clothes, and this is genuine. And the Amalekites just having to sit and wait. This is probably not the response he was expecting. I mean, we might think David would say, or maybe he wouldn't say something, but maybe he would sigh with relief. Maybe he would be able to say, you know what? Saul has caused turmoil for me for 10 years. I can breathe easy tonight. I have one less person who's trying to chase me down. And yet he doesn't sigh with relief. He weeps with tears. And he mourns. They mourn for Saul. They mourn for Jonathan. They mourn for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. He expresses great grief, and he postpones this conversation with the Amalekite. This can wait. Grief needed to take place first. But then, later that day, he does speak. Verse 13. Then David said to the young man who told him, "Where are you from?" And he answered, "I am the son of an alien, an Amalekite." And that's basically his death sentence. He did not plead the fifth there. And David said to him, "How was it that you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David called one of the young men and said, "Go near and execute him." And he struck him so that he died. And David said to him, "Your blood is on your own head, for your mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" If you remember, God had put a death sentence over all the Amalekites back in Exodus chapter 17, because every time you see the Amalekites, they're always opposed to God. They're always have this heart of wickedness and sin. And so God had called Saul in 1 Samuel to destroy all of them, and he spared some of them. He didn't destroy them all. And that was part of Saul's downfall in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 3. "Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have, and do not spare them." And yet some had been spared. And so here David is executing the sentence that had been given years and years earlier. And you might think, well, this guy, if he didn't kill Saul, is he still deserving of death? He's deserving of death for two reasons. One, he's Amalekite. All Amalekites are deserving of death. And two, if he didn't do the deed in his action, he did it in his heart. If he had found Saul alive, and I don't think he did, but if he had, guess what he would have done? He would have done exactly what he said he did, but I think probably didn't happen because he didn't have the opportunity. Saul's probably already dead. So David is saying, you've sentenced your own self to death, and he puts him to death. And so we see here this sentence and this death of an Amalekite. The Amalekites in Scripture, they're a picture of our flesh. They're a picture of our old man who needs to be crucified on the cross. There's no redeeming of it. God's going to bring us and give us a new life, a new nature, but that old self, it's put on the cross, and there's nothing that can be done. It just has to be put away. And so that's why in the New Testament, it still says to us that we need to put to death the deeds of the body, In Galatians 5, it speaks of this battle between the flesh and the spirit. It says in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 22, that you put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts. Also in Colossians chapter 3, verse 9. Do not lie to one another, since you have put off the old man with his deeds and have put on the new man who is renewed in knowledge according to the image of him. And Romans talks about this also. So David puts to death this Amalekite, this flesh, this picture of sin and opposition to God's ways. And then we see David's lament, verse 17. Then David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son. And he told them to teach the children of Judah the song of the bow. Indeed, it is written in the book of Jasher. And so we're going to read here this poem or this lament that he writes. I appreciate Ralph Davis has this description of what a lament is. He says, a lament is a formal expression of grief or distress, one that can be written, read, learned, practiced, and repeated. A lament differs from the informal, spontaneous, immediate outbursts of grief, like those of verses 11 and 12. Lament is no less sorrowful or sincere, but it is a vehicle for the mind as well as for the emotions. Lament is an expression of thoughtful grief. And so David takes a time after he weeps to write a lament. And it's for his own sake, and it's for the sake of the people to be able to have with them years later. And this lament is both to memorialize and remember Jonathan and Saul in an honorable way, as well as to, I think, empower and encourage soldiers in the future. Like, don't forget Gilboa. When you're in a battle with the Philistines, fight. To be like the Israelite soldiers nowadays, being taken to Masada and saying, don't forget, never forget. Or soldiers or people, you know, going to the scene of 9/11 and where that took place, or some of those scenes, and never forget. That it can be a resolve in our fights and our battles in the future to remember these things in the past. And so David writes this, and I want you to hear how he speaks not just of his friend Jonathan, but how he speaks of Saul. Verse 19. The beauty of Israel is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. Lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice. Lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. O mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, nor let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings, for the shield of the mighty is cast away there, the shield of Saul, not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. O daughter of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with luxury, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan was slain in your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war perished. He doesn't just speak honorably of Jonathan. He speaks honorably of his former enemy, of Saul. Because David never saw Saul as his enemy. David saw Saul as a lost friend. Saul saw David as an enemy, but David never reciprocated that attitude. Saul was a lost friend, and he never lost sight of that picture of the person who he had seen and loved years and years earlier. Had David seen Saul do some terrible things, make some bad decisions in his life? Yes. But he doesn't record that here. It's selective reporting, selective recording. He's not lying, he's not fabricating, but he's choosing to tell what should be told. And in a sense, like Hebrews 11, he's passing by things that don't need to be told at this time. In verse 19, he says, "The beauty of Israel is slain." He's speaking of both David, or both Saul and Jonathan. He doesn't want the news to be spread in the Philistine area in verse 20. He knows it is, but he's saying these are things that shouldn't be spread. This isn't news to gloat over. This is something to weep over. Verse 20, "O mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, nor let there be rain upon you." He wants the place to be memorialized, to not let it be used for normal purposes, for farming or fielding, but to be a place of remembering. He says at the end of verse 21, "The shield of Saul not anointed with oil." Back then, they would have leather shields that would be wood and leather, and they would oil them before battle. And he's indicating here that probably Saul's shield at the end of the battle, it's not oiled anymore. It's been used, and it's probably been stained with blood and dirt, and it's just there in the mud. And from the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. He's picturing them in this battle, even, that they fought well to the end. And I don't know Saul's last decisions in his life. We don't have that recorded for us. We do know that he went into this battle being told, "You're going to die." Maybe he, in this battle, turned to the Lord and says, "God, I need you. This is my fate, but I'm going to fight well to the end." Would you go into a battle knowing you were going to die in that battle? Saul doesn't run away from this battle, and it doesn't seem he tries to hide himself in this battle from who he is, like Ahab, who tries to conceal himself when he runs into a battle being told you're going to die. We don't see that with Saul. So he speaks of their valor and their strength as soldiers and warriors. "Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. He sees them as friends with one another, father and son. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with luxury, who put on ornaments of gold on your apparel." If you think of the reign of Saul, and you compare it to the period of the judges, they lived in great prosperity compared to the season and the centuries prior. Saul did a lot for the nation. He unified them. They were fractured. They were like the colonies of the U.S. at the beginning, where they're so independent, and yet they gathered together and they became one. Under Saul's reign, they became one nation, not just individual tribes. And it was to their benefit. They grew through that. There was wealth and benefit through that unity, that healthy unity. And then David speaks of his friendship with Jonathan, how the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. "Jonathan was slain in your high places. I'm distressed for you, my brother Jonathan." He was his brother-in-law. He had married Jonathan's sister, but also they were like brothers in the Lord. "You have been very pleasant to me." And this is something I need to address, because some people distort this. "Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women." David here describes his wonderful friendship with Jonathan. And he says, I knew no other friend like this in life. That's what he's saying. He's not speaking in any sexual terms here. And it's unfortunate some people try to draw from this that David and Jonathan had some sexual relationship. That is not something that this text is saying, nor do we see any indication of that anywhere else in their interaction with one another. I think it's sad that today in our culture, it's hard for people to identify a close friendship without thinking or assuming maybe there's sexuality in it. So if you've got two guys that are really good friends, well, maybe there's something more than that. David and Jonathan were great friends. And David, he didn't have the best of marriages. And he's saying, I knew in you a greater friend than I had in what should have been the closest friendship that I had in life, relationship with my wife. But I didn't have that companionship, that friendship with his wives the way that he did with Jonathan, a close friend. Now, if you think of a friend, C.S. Lewis, he has a book that he's written called Four Loves. And there's friendship love and there's the eros love. There's a sexual love and they're different. David had this friendship love with Jonathan. Jonathan was a helper to David. Jonathan submitted to David. Jonathan showed sacrificial love to David. There was a giving of himself for the sake of another. He joyfully took the second place. And if you think of both of these individuals, David and Jonathan both thrived in their lives because they knew their place in life. Jonathan was able to be an excellent second to David because he knew God hasn't picked me to be a king. He's picked David to be king. And David was able to be a good king when he became king because he knew it's not my place to cut Saul out of my life. It's God's place to dispose of him in his time. And so David was able to be a good king because he knew his place and he waited for God's timing. And so we see here just a great description of friendship, that it's two individuals looking out for the interests of another, looking to encourage and edify and build up another. And then he ends, verse 27, how the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. As we wrap up tonight, I appreciate how David writes this lament of Saul. Sometimes when we hear people pass away, there can be people who say they got what's coming to them. And I think as Christians, like for example, Stephen Hawking passed away recently. He died from Lou Gehrig's disease, had a long battle with that. From every indication, it seemed like he never turned to the Lord. He was an atheist and an unbeliever until the very end. But Robbie Zacharias wrote just a nice article in response to Stephen Hawking. And he didn't speak of where Stephen Hawking is now, because we don't know for sure. I mean, you never know what person's last decisions are in their life. But he did speak of what he could speak on. And I think we can learn from David's description of Saul here when we go to a memorial service. And there's not much good to say. Well, maybe we shouldn't say anything at all. Like sometimes your mom has said that to you in the past. If you don't have anything good to say, don't say anything at all. But other times, there are some things that we can say. There are some things that we can speak and look for just a way of honoring people who God has made in his image. And even if they've fallen from that image in a very tragic way, they're still made in God's image, and we can respect that. So, one question or one application. In each of us, there's two responses to Saul's death here. There's the response of a concealed glee, and there's the response of a chronicled grief, a written out grief. And in our life, when we see tragedies or troubles or situations that cause somebody else to be dropped or disappear from a position in life, do we look at that as an opportunity, or do we lament? In this situation, David did not say, "Finally, I get to be king." That's not recorded in here. He is going to be king, but he's not looking at what's in it for me. He's not like the person who the person's passed away and they're just ready to read the will. They're sad. He's sad over the passing of his friend, of Saul. And in each one of us, I think we have a little Malachite inside. We have this flesh inside that there is a danger when somebody passes away, whether it's a family member or whether it's just somebody who's caused turmoil for us for many, many years, to just be glad or grateful or look for the opportunity in it rather than see how God would have us to respond. And God wants to kill that Amalekite inside of us. He wants to crucify that Amalekite, and he wants us to not, as 1 Corinthians chapter 13 says, rejoice in iniquity. That's not what love does, but love rejoices in the truth. It looks for the truth to rejoice in. It doesn't think evil. It does bear all things. It does believe all things. It does hope all things. It endures all things, and it never fails. And so, as we wrap up, I think of the gospel and how it's the reason David was able to do what he did and the Amalekite wasn't is because David was set free from having to contend for position. He was able to rest in the position that God had given him. He didn't have to fight for it. He knew his position in life. And when we know our position in life, which really our position is to be second and let Jesus be first, then in whatever happens in life, we can respond appropriately. Colossians chapter 1, verses 16 through 18, we'll end with this. Colossians 1, verse 16 through 18. For by him all things were created that are on heaven, or in heaven, and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things consist, and he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he may have the preeminence. Let's pray. God, we thank you for this chapter. We thank you for David's response in grieving over the loss of life of a man who had lost goodness in his own life. And yet David was able to see your goodness and your grace still in the midst of that brokenness. Help us to have eyes to see that in others around us. Help us, God, to lament in life and not to take the alternative that the Amalekite did here. And I thank you, Lord, that David was able to rest in you and wait on you. And if you have positions or opportunities for us in the future, I pray that you would help us to not have to fight for those, but to just wait on you and rely on you. And we thank you that you really are the one who gets the first preeminent position. We don't have to wrestle for that. We can let you have that place and be second behind you and under you and with you. And so we thank you. We thank you for David. We thank you that he is a man who lived with unbroken faith. He's a man who made mistakes, but he's a man who was able to walk with you through those mistakes and in all the circumstances of life, and help us to do the same. I pray these things in your son's name. Amen.